Radio.
G.K. Chesterton on Faith, a talk by Carl Schmoog at Reasons for Hope 2014, held at the Benedict XVI Retreat Centre in Grosvale, Sydney.
Thanks very much, Richard. It's lovely to be here. What a magnificent spot this is. Thanks to my wife, Virginia, and I got here without getting lost, which is pretty extraordinary. I think that G.K. Chesterton would have felt very much at home at a conference named Reasons for Hope. He would have recognised immediately the famous words of St. Peter, that you should always have your answer ready for people who ask you the reason for the hope that you all have. Chesterton devoted his life to explaining the reason for the hope that was within him. Well, who was G.K. Chesterton? I'd like to say just a few brief things about him by way of introduction before going on to look at his life of faith. He may be a familiar name to you as an essayist or the writer of detective fiction. He created a priest detective, as we were talking about just a few moments ago, by the name of Father Brown, and a TV series of the Father Brown's stories has been showing in Australia in recent months. But he also wrote novels and poetry, plays and literary criticism, biographies of various people, including saints like St. Thomas Aquinas and Francis of Assisi, works of philosophy and theology, and of social commentary, to name just a few. He was a phenomenally prolific writer. He wrote nearly 100 books, produced more than 4,000 newspaper columns. He edited his own weekly magazine, which was called GK's Weekly. Probably the most amazing sign of his creative energy was a memory his secretary had of him dictating to her an article on one topic while writing on a pad in front of him an article on another topic for two different newspapers. A few years ago, I had occasion to speak at an international Chesterton conference in Argentina, in the city of Buenos Aires, where Pope Francis comes from. I was amazed at the popular interest in Chesterton on the part of so many people in Argentina, and in fact throughout South America. Chesterton showed an ability, I think, to reach out and to speak powerfully to a great number of varied peoples, not only English, as he was, and European, but North and South American, Asian, notably in Japan, and perhaps in time African as well. It's a sign, I think, of the universal quality of his thought and his writing, that his transcendental wisdom could wear the clothes of every culture. His books have been translated into many languages, and in his lifetime he became an exceptionally well-known advocate of the Catholic faith throughout the world. In fact, when he died in 1936, a cardinal in Rome, who later became Pope, Pope Pius XII, gave Chesterton the title Defender of the Faith. Did Chesterton have an influence in Australia? And the answer is very much so. He has had great appeal in this country over many years, and his influence has continued, I think, into the 21st century. He was a key intellectual inspiration, an inspiration through his mind, on the minds of others, on a vital movement of Catholic higher education, what was called the Campion Society, which was named in honour of the great scholar and martyr of 16th century England, St. Edmund Campion. And it emerged in the 1930s, firstly in Melbourne, and then extended to Sydney and all of the capital cities of Australia and also many country areas. My father, for example, lived in Albury. And he was an early member of the Campion Society. Chesterton was also significant in the creation of Campion College. As Richard mentioned, the Australia's first and only undergraduate college offering a core program in the liberal arts, a broad program of studies, preparing students for any walk of life, as well as for life itself. That college, of course, is named after St. Edmund Campion, And in fact, I'm not being entirely facetious when I say that at the time when we came to think about a suitable name for Campion College, I certainly pondered the possibility of calling it Chesterton College, believing that he was a one-man liberal arts curriculum. I had in mind a set for reading only the works of G.K. Chesterton. Well, I can think of a narrower curriculum. He was in so many ways a model, I think, of the kind of graduate which Campion strives to develop. Firstly, he had a mind of tremendous sharpness and depth, a profound capacity for reason and for using intellectual judgment. Secondly, he commanded a prodigious knowledge across the liberal arts, the key disciplines which still shape and inspire the mind of an educated person: history, philosophy, literature, language, theology, and science. These are the foundational subjects that are studied in a liberal arts program and are certainly studied at Campion. Thirdly, he was a superb communicator, both in writing, of course, but also as a speaker and a broadcaster. He made many broadcasts, for example, over the BBC in London in the later years of his life. And finally, and most crucially, I think, he was a man of great faith and spiritual devotion and moral character. If he was and remains an author of global dimensions, known throughout the world, I think this is certainly in keeping with his great size. He was a physically huge man. You can get a little bit of a hint of that in the handout that I've distributed. He was tall. In weight, he was nearly 160 kilograms. He was also remarkably absent-minded. And there's a story of his travelling on a bus in London on that occasion, and how he absent-mindedly stood up in a gesture of politeness and gave his seat to three ladies who were standing there. So his absent-mindedness was legendary. He himself used to say that absence of mind is simply the presence of mind on something else. Now, I've tried that excuse on my wife at various times without any success. Perhaps the most celebrated example of Chesterton's presence of mind on something else, which was often something he might have been writing in the train or wherever, was a telegram that he sent to his wife Frances when he left for a speaking engagement in some city in the UK. He was stranded in an English village called Market Harborough, and the telegram to his wife simply said, "Am in Market Harborough, where ought I to be?" She just telegrammed back, said, "Come home, then I'll redirect you." Well, to turn to Chesterton's life of faith, he was not born a Catholic. He was brought up in a vaguely Christian environment, and by the time he became a teenager, he had lost his religious faith and was a complete agnostic. Gradually, he found his way back to a solid Christian belief and eventually to the Catholic Church. His most famous work, explaining his journey of faith and providing what I think is still the most compelling justification for being a Christian, and specifically a Catholic Christian, even though Chesterton did not formally, in a formal sense, become a Catholic until much later. That book is called Orthodoxy. This, as you can see, is an old edition of it, but it's come out and been reprinted again and again, and is readily enough available. I can still recall quite vividly the impact, the huge impact this book had on me as a young person. I just started a course at university and was beginning to encounter challenges to my Catholic faith, and Chesterton's book, Orthodoxy, helped me enormously. Firstly, I came to understand more deeply the faith into which I had been baptised. And secondly, it gave me a surge of confidence, a bit like an electric charge, in fact, that the Catholic faith was intellectually defensible, that it could stand up to the challenges and the criticisms that the world would throw at it. A basic reason, I think, for Chesterton's ability to answer these challenges to faith is that he had experienced them at first hand. And he was deeply unimpressed by the thought of many of the popular leaders, popular intellectual leaders of his time. What, curiously enough, moved him in the direction of Christianity, back towards Christianity, was anti-Christian writing. It was the skeptics and the opponents of Christianity that brought him back to Christianity. They sowed in my mind, he said, the first wild doubts of doubt. So he began to question his doubts. There's a famous English comedy scriptwriter, Frank Newell, who once admitted to being what he called a lapsed agnostic. He told an audience in London, "My doubts have begun to waver." So this was very much Chesterton's position. He found the prevailing literature against Christianity highly unconvincing. In fact, it so challenged the sceptical or even hostile attitude to Christianity that it undermined it and actually fostered belief. Chesterton's writings add enormously, I think, to what I would call the spiritual survival kit we all need in today's culture. We need a strong faith, a depth of conviction, if we are to be sustained as Catholics. So Orthodoxy is a book I highly recommend to each and every one of you. I'd hope that you too could gain a new sense of informed conviction about your faith, just as I was fortunate enough to receive. That it would give you a strong intellectual and cultural framework for your understanding of reality, both human and divine reality. And that it would help you to find and to spell out the reasons for hope that lie within you. As a convert, Chesterton was often asked, why did he become a Catholic? Many people have given explanations of their conversion over the years, but Chesterton's answer was a brief and rather stunning reply, I think. He said he became a Catholic to get rid of his sins. He'd become a Catholic because of the Church's practical power of dealing with sin. Now, this was a surprising answer for two reasons. First, it may be thought that Chesterton's reputation as a writer and speaker engaging in public debate on all manner of current topics. And because of this, he would offer a reason for his conversion based, say, on philosophy or on history, the compelling logic of the Catholic faith as an explanation of life, or the Church's long record of influence in history, its influence on human civilization. Now, Chesterton, of course, recognised and wrote about both of these realities. The Church's ability to shed light on the meaning and purpose and destiny of human life, and the Church's long record of influence on human civilization and history. Its role, for example, in inspiring so many leaders in society over centuries, and in founding such important institutions such as hospitals and universities. But when it came to saying why he became a Catholic, Chesterton pointed rather to a personal factor, a highly spiritual motive, a reason related to his soul. Now, there was a second surprising aspect of Chesterton's explanation, and that is it seems so out of keeping with the well-known, widely documented image of his innocence and his goodness, his kindly character, his sense of humour, his capacity to remain friends with those people, and there were many of them, such as the playwright George Bernard Shaw, many others, with whom he engaged continuously in intellectual debate. Remarkably, I think, for a man who was involved in so many controversies, Chesterton was able to distinguish between the person and the idea. He could argue without quarrelling. In fact, he said, rather famously on one occasion, the problem with a quarrel is that it interferes with an argument. I might mention at this point that there's a serious proposal going forward that G.K. Chesterton should be declared a saint. His holiness, in fact, is gaining increasing attention, not only in his homeland of England, but overseas as well. Pope Francis, when he was Cardinal Archbishop of Buenos Aires, was a member of the Chesterton Society in Argentina. He approved the text of the prayer for Chesterton's canonisation, and he served as chairman of the Chesterton Conference in Buenos Aires that I mentioned earlier. So Duke Hayes Corliss, as it were, has a friend in the Vatican, I think one could say. Now, in considering Chesterton on faith and the belief that it is an essential for humanity, let me focus briefly on three things. How his spiritual life was sharpened and deepened by his own sense of sin, his own sense of unworthiness in the presence of God, his own humility. Secondly, the ways in which his spiritual outlook grew out of a natural attitude, a theology, one might say, of wonder and surprise and thanksgiving. And thirdly, the major aspects of the Catholic devotional tradition, our tradition of prayer and devotion, which appealed to Chesterton. Well, let me just focus on the first theme. I've already highlighted a crucial fact about Chesterton, which he emphasised in his explanation for becoming a Catholic, and that is he had a very deep and realistic grasp of evil and of the personal evil that is sin. In his autobiography, in the section where he spoke about his becoming a Catholic to get rid of his sins, he commented on the Church's understanding of evil. And this, he had to admit, surprised him. This is what he said: that the Catholic Church knew more about good than I did was easy to believe. That you knew more about evil than I did seemed incredible. He wrote an early essay on this topic called The Diabolist. The Diabolist is someone who worships the devil, and this essay brings out very powerfully a major theme of Chesterton's writings, a key understanding that he had about modern culture, namely the extent to which it's lost a sense of what is objectively true and real, of what is true whether a person recognises or not. And also the fact that our culture has lost the ability to make clear intellectual distinctions, basically saying that truth doesn't really exist in any objective way, it's all a matter of opinion. Just to put it this way, supposing there is no difference between good and evil, or between false and true, what is the difference between up and down? So this essay, The Diabolist, says a great deal about Chesterton's faith and spiritual life. It records his encounter with evil, his consciousness of sin, his sense of a loss of innocence, and his spirit of humility. All are relevant to a life of faith, and they characterise Chesterton's attitude and experience. Not long before his conversion, which took place in 1922, Chesterton wrote to a friend, Monsignor Ronald Knox, who was a well-known convert from Anglicanism, translator of the Bible. He was a chaplain, Catholic chaplain at Oxford University. And Chesterton recalled a toy theatre which his father had built for him as a boy. And he used this as an image of the innocence he felt he had lost as an adult. Together with another author of the time, the French Catholic novelist Georges Bernanos, Chesterton had a deep sense of the loss of childhood. This loss he saw in a spiritual sense, that is, as a symbol of our separation from God, an awareness of our sinfulness, and also of the human longing for redemption, and the crucial importance of the Church in satisfying that longing for redemption. He believed that the recovery of childlike attitudes, not childish, but childlike attitudes and values, was the pathway to communion with God. And I think Chesterton and Georges Bernanos, the French writer, took very seriously Christ's words that unless we be converted and become like little children, we will never enter the kingdom of heaven. Well, let me move now to a second aspect of Chesterton's faith, and that is his great sense of wonder and gratitude about the created world. This formed the primary ground of his relationship with God. Early in his writing career, he spelled out his essential philosophy. "Of one thing I am certain," he said, that the age needs, first and foremost, to be startled, to be taught the nature of wonder. Such an outlook was central to his understanding of life and of faith. And even when he abandoned Christianity during his teenage years, he never lost his fundamental sense of loyalty and gratitude. He said, "I hung on to the remains of religion by one thin thread of thanks." As he put it, one thin thread of thanks. He always harboured a profound love of creation and the spirit of gratitude which that love excited. Perhaps nowhere more memorably expressed than in a well-known passage from his book Orthodoxy, and I quote, "Children are grateful when Santa Claus puts in their stockings gifts of toys or sweets. Could I not be grateful to Santa Claus when he put in my stockings the gift of two miraculous legs?" We thank people for birthday presents of cigars and slippers. Can I thank no one for the birthday present of birth? There's something, I think, distinctly pure and primitive about the primary celebration of life in Chesterton, his great connection with life and its sources. There's a vision of natural splendour, akin perhaps to Adam's condition before the fall in the Garden of Eden. An intuition, a deep intuition on Chesterton's part of fundamental love and joy. Now, in his mature years, his natural intuitions were elevated and transformed into supernatural understandings. In the final years of his life, he was still combating what he saw as a suffocating spirit of pessimism and weariness that threatened to overwhelm Western culture at that time, and still does, perhaps in a more pervasive way, vividly captured, I think, in Pope John Paul II's famous phrase, "the culture of death." Now, the third and final theme I'd like to address briefly is the devotional side of Chesterton's religious life, the nature of his religious experience, of his experience of faith. He certainly saw it as an essential for humanity. And there are various aspects of this, but two important signs of his religious experience that underpin his faith. Firstly, he cherished a great interest in the saints. He produced biographies, as I mentioned earlier, of St. Francis of Assisi and St. Thomas Aquinas, which allowed him to focus on the two figures who represented those aspects of the Catholic faith that he found most inspiring. On the one hand, a love of the poor, a love of those in need, and on the other, a devotion to the truth. And it's summed up neatly in the last lines of a sonnet, a small poem that Monsignor Ronald Knox wrote when Chesterton died, asking God's favour on Chesterton's soul by quoting the two saints, Thomas Aquinas and Francis of Assisi. And these are the two lines. "Take him," said Thomas, "for he served the truth. Take him," said Francis, "for he loved the poor." Now, apart from the saints, the second and highly significant focus, I think, of Chesterton's religious devotion was undoubtedly the Virgin Mary. In a book of essays published just before he died, he wrote about the devotion to Mary. And he noted that Our Lady reminds us especially of Christ, of God incarnate, of God made man, and that she was a vital part of God's gifts to us and of the revelation of his mercy and love. In some degree, Chesterton said, Our Lady gathers up and embodies all those elements of the heart and the higher instincts, which are what he called legitimate shortcuts to the love of God. Legitimate shortcuts to the love of God. Chesterton noted that his approach to the Catholic Church was very much an approach to Mary. The instant he said, "I remembered the Catholic Church, I remembered her. When I tried to forget the Catholic Church, I tried to forget her." And in my mind, the qualities of Chesterton, the phenomenal power of his mind, the richness of his knowledge, his ability to capture meaning in a single image, and in a mere handful of words, And finally, the sheer beauty of his faith. All these qualities are summed up in a short poem that he wrote called A Little Litany. And in this poem, A Little Litany, he depicts Mary and the child Jesus. Jesus is crawling up from his mother's lap, and reaching her face, he looks into her eyes. Because Mary is a lady of spiritual purity, free of original sin, only her eyes could accept the direct gaze of God. And Chesterton writes, "He, that is God, found his mirror there. The only glass," Chesterton said, "that would not break with that unbearable light, till in a corner of the high, dark house, God looked on God, as ghosts meet in the night," he says. What an extraordinary image that is. The child Jesus peers into his mother's eye and finds a mirror of himself. God looked on God through the incarnational purity of his mother. As the Chesterton critic Dale Alquist has asked, can we find in all of literature a more profound and provocative image than God looking at God in the reflection of his mother's eye? Now, Chesterton was an artist, and only a man, I think, with the eyes of faith could conceive of such a stupendous reality. The English novelist Anthony Burgess, who wrote books like A Clockwork Orange, once said of Chesterton that he knew what it was like to live on the level of eternity. Well, the hope and the prayer which I have, with which I'd like to close, is this: that Chesterton's vision of a life of faith, expressed in his writings and embodied in his life, will come to be recognised more and more in the 21st century, and that each of you will feel inclined to plunge into his writings. I think you'll find you're in for a treat.
That was Carl Schmood with G.K. Chesterton on faith. For more from Reasons for Hope 2014, visit cradio.org.au.